From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn about a tool that can help connect Black and Latinx youth in Milwaukee to education and job resources. We'll highlight some films to see this weekend at the 6th Annual Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival.
We probably have more directors and producers that are showing up in person this year than we have ever had. And I think it's for the same reason, that it's finally an in-person festival and they're excited to be out.
We'll learn about the Festival City Symphony's upcoming season. Plus, a new documentary tells the story of a fighter pilot downed over Italy and his family finding the crash site 70 years later.
And I read all 350 letters and the diary and everything, and then I compiled a timeline and then started using excerpts to create a script.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. We'll start with this. Transitioning from high school to higher education or from higher education to the job market is a pivotal time in a young person's life. It can present challenges, especially for students of color. The Black and Latino Ecosystem and Support Transition Hub, also known as Blessed Hub at Marquette University, is working to support young people during these moments. Recently, they released a digital ecosystem map to help show what organizations and resources are out there for Black and Latino young people here in Milwaukee. Gabriel Velez is an assistant professor in the Department for Educational Policy and Leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang.
Thank you so much, Gabriel, for being here on Lake Effect with me.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really honored to be here with you.
Just to start right off, you helped put together the Milwaukee Ecosystem for Black and Latina Youth Report, which is essentially a report showing the resources that are available to Milwaukee youth who are Black and Latino or Latina in accessing or finding a path to college. So just to start right off, what does going to college look like for Black and Latinx youth in Milwaukee?
To be quite fair and honest, I think a lot of our work is focused on the organizational side. So I can tell you the types of organizations and support that's going on. From what we have been doing and working with organizations, it's clear that there are a lot of great supports. There are a lot of great organizations doing different types of work. What's not as clear is what that looks like from the youth side in terms of how they access those and how those help them overcome the challenges tied to segregation, to educational inequity, and to other issues that we face here in Milwaukee.
And could you tell me a little bit about Blessed Hub? What does it stand for? What is the mission and the goals of the hub?
So the Blessed Hub, which stands for the Black and Latino Latina Ecosystem and Support Transition Hub, is a project that really developed out of two visionaries, one at Marquette and one at MATC at Milwaukee Area Technical College. That's Dr. Rob Smith, who runs the Center for Urban Research, Teaching and Outreach at Marquette, another great acronym, CURTO. And then Dr. Walter Lanier over at MATC. And they had this real vision of trying to create a space, both physical and sort of virtual, that would be a center for bringing folks together who do this work, do the work to try and support Black and Latino, Latina students in the Milwaukee area, but also then a space for resources for those organizations and for the youth and students themselves. And so our goal and our aim is really to try and be a facilitator, be a space where we create synergy across organizations, and be a support for the work being done. And we enter that, you know, and we try and take an approach of being really humble and not being prescriptive. So not saying, you know, we're going to figure out exactly what's wrong and we're going to fix it, or we're going to tell you what you need to do, but rather being just a connector, being a catalyst, and then being a place that can really link folks together and try and break down some of the barriers and silos that sometimes create hurdles for the work that's being done, the good work that's being done in Milwaukee by these various organizations.
Could you give me an example of how this hub operates? What does it look like on a day-to-day basis?
What the work has looked like really to date and over the last year and has been getting a real sense of what this ecosystem is like. So we've been meeting with a lot of organizations, and those include nonprofits, folks who are in education, and government organizations as well, activists also, and just trying to understand the work that they do, the partnerships that they have, and then who they're connected to and what are their understandings of this ecosystem. And so the day-to-day right now has been a lot of individual meetings with these folks, and then also trying to build out different types of spaces where we can bring folks who are knowledgeable in this to share this knowledge and connect and talk with others. And so that means organizing panels at presentations. And, you know, that's kind of where we're at right now. And as we're moving away from being so restricted by the pandemic, we're looking to do more sort of day-to-day touch points and more work with youth themselves. And so we're developing a youth consultant program to have young people sharing with us the issues and the concerns that they face and what this ecosystem looks like. We're developing also a project where we're going to collect from young people across the city their experiences and their understanding of what this ecosystem is. And then, you know, we're hoping to kind of build this out one day for this to be a space where young people can come and access resources in the sense of actually providing them with direct support if they need help with, let's say, filling out their FAFSA or college applications or job applications, but then also being a facilitator where we bring different organizations in to discuss and work on issues collectively. We connect these young people to the organizations that are providing resources and support for what they might need. And then lastly, the other kind of element of that would be to be conducting research on this ecosystem. And what I mean by that is right now, you know, I could quote a couple of statistics and their broad understandings of some of the obstacles and inequities for higher education and employment access for Black and Latino, Latina youth. But those numbers aren't always as telling of what the experiences are like. And they're often focused on certain types of metrics that are driven either by the government or by specific types of funders. And we're hoping to really build out a research that's maybe more inclusive and more understanding of other types of ways of thinking about what success looks like for these young people.
What does centering youth perspectives look like in future reports, and how has that been done already, and how are you going to build on that?
So I mentioned a little bit about, you know, our youth consultant program, where we really want to have young people telling us what the issues and concerns they face are. We also really want to encourage these young people as we start to build this out to tell us that we're wrong, to tell us this is not what you should be doing, or this is not what your takeaway should be from this map, or things need to look different or be done differently. I think also part of it is really giving young people an authentic space to share their perspectives and to amplify that. And I think one of the things that we can do with the work we have, both because of the spaces we're connected to, but also some of the power that does come with being at an institution like Marquette, where there are a lot of resources, is that we can amplify these voices and perspectives, and we can share them broadly. To date, some of that has been work that we've done in terms of focus groups. And so we did a small research project this past year where we had focus groups with students from Marquette, UWM, and MATC. And we had them talking about what their experience was like of Milwaukee. And what we did, and the way we kind of centered or tried to center their voice, was rather than have, say, me, who's this, you know, white professor at Marquette of Latino heritage, run the focus group, we actually had students at each of the institutions who we trained, and then they ran these conversations. And they were students of color themselves. And so they ran these conversations with talking about their own experience and drawing on that and sharing that as well. And so what we found kind of coming out of that was, you know, rather than it being something that was driven just by our questions and by our kind of pre-thinking going in, it really created sort of authentic conversations where the young people at least described feeling comfortable sharing and really fed off of these facilitators who were students like themselves.
With this ecosystem, with this tool, with this map, how can people use this? How can people who are seeing this for the first time use this in their own day-to-day work?
So to give a little background on that, so the tool we did develop out of this past year's work is this visualization map, which is really catchy. I think if you take a look at it, you're like, wow, this is really exciting. And then the second thought often is like, well, what do I do with this? Or what is all this involved? You know, it can be almost like a little overwhelming because it is new and it has many sort of elements to it. The tool itself, to sort of explain it at a high level, is basically a visualization of all the meetings that we've done, all the efforts we've done to try and understand different organizations that are working on supporting Black and Latino, Latina youth and students through the kind of high school to post-secondary to career space in Milwaukee. We've kind of put that into a map and tried to build that out as this visual. We call this an ecosystem, and part of it being an ecosystem is that it's constantly evolving and changing and shifting. And so the first thing I would say to folks, particularly those who maybe recognize that they're not a part of it if they do this work, or that there are gaps, is to reach out to us and let us know. We want to be told, hey, you need to add this, or we want to be told, we want to be a part of this, or this is missing something. Because we recognize that it is incomplete and is constantly in development, but then also that it's a map that is going to be constantly trying to catch up to an ecosystem that's always shifting. It provides a great way of trying to understand the work beyond just any one organization, any one school, any one space. Because, you know, there are real resource and time limitations for those who are doing this work. And so to give an example, if you're an educator, administrator in one school, right, you might know the groups that you partner with, you might have a sense of some of the community organizations, right? But there's so many pulls on your time and on your resources that trying to understand how your experience at your school and how your young people's experience at your school fits into a broader sort of systemic level across Milwaukee can be really challenging. And so the map can help organizations and educators and even the young people themselves try and get an understanding of what's going on more broadly.
Gabriel Velez is an assistant professor in the Department for Educational Policy and Leadership in the College of Education at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. The man accused of killing 17 people at a high school in Parkland, Florida, pleaded guilty this week. It's now up to a jury to decide if he'll face the death penalty or life in prison. Unfortunately, Milwaukee is not exempt from mass shooting situations like the one in Parkland. Gun violence is an issue that has continued to plague the city. But how we remember these mass shootings and memorialize them is unique to each of these events. Journalist Adam Rogan wrote about how we memorialize these sites in an article for Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers about it last year.
Some of the more infamous shootings, like the mass murder at the Sikh temple, have had a really lasting impact on our collective memory. But what are some of the mass shootings that have happened here in the Milwaukee area that we may have forgotten about?
I think now that we're looking back, it's been almost 8 years since the Sikh temple shooting. Is that shooting stood out so vividly in our minds because partially because they got national media attention. It was on CNN either that night or the next morning. Anderson Cooper was here. And so it got all that attention. And it was, I think, partially just because of its origin as a hate crime and being this minority community that Oak Creek really rallied around. But there's some other shootings that kind of went by the wayside. The deadliest mass shooting in Wisconsin history wasn't even that one. It was on March 12th, 2005 at a Sheraton Hotel, or what's now a Sheraton Hotel in Brookfield, where 7 people, 8 if you include the shooter, died. And that was a deadly shooting, but it was one that was, it didn't get this huge national attention. They never really figured out the motive. It was somebody who had some mental illness problems, who was a member of a church that was celebrating at that hotel. They were in one of the conference areas. And it was the deadliest mass shooting in Wisconsin history, and I didn't know about it. And it kind of shows just how quickly we can move on. There was one that I remember, because it was only a couple months after the Oak Creek Sikh temple shooting, was at Azana Salon and Spa, which is actually not far from the Brookfield Hotel where the shooting was in 05, where 3 people and the shooter all died. And that one's a little more remembered because the people at that spa wanted to remember their coworkers, and so that lasted. And the Molson Coors shooting, obviously, is a unique scenario. I don't remember the last time I even talked about it because I think this coronavirus happened, and so we all just kind of moved on from it, at least for the time being.
Yeah. A big part of what your piece looks at, of course, is how these sites look today, essentially, whether or not people have created memorials to what happened. So when you look at these different sites around the Milwaukee area, what are the different ways that they've chosen to remember what happened or not?
So, for example, with the Sikh temple shooting, there's a memorial inside the library at the temple with just photos to each of those who died from it. I'm just really remembering who they were, especially since a lot of them were really instrumental to that temple and that community. At least one of them, if not two, I believe two of them were priests in the temple. So obviously they wanted to kind of remember these kind of founding father figures for them. At the Azana Salon, there's inside one of the three people who died, their workstation was turned into kind of a memorial, and it's still there. If you went there for, you know, just a normal spa day or getting a haircut or something, you might not notice it because it's not, like, super present, but it's still there, I think, mainly for the owner and for the co-workers to remember the lives that were lost. But then if you go to the Sheraton Hotel, there's nothing there. It's interesting that it's the site of the deadliest shooting in the history of our state, and it's just a normal hotel. I went there, I think it was in March, and inside one of the conference rooms where the shootings happened, there was a conference going on, just like it was a normal day. And it made this really interesting moment of something really significant happened here. Quite a few lives were lost, but moved on. With Molson Coors, within a week or two, the facility was back up and running. When I was working on the story, the Molson didn't really know what they were going to do at the plant long term, because obviously it was still pretty fresh. And there were, of course, in the whole neighborhood, there were, you know, balloons and flower memorials and stuff like that. But in terms of permanent remembrances for it, there wasn't really anything yet, at least.
Yeah. When you've talked to people at these different sites, what has been the rationale for either memorializing these spaces or not memorializing them, keeping what happened there kind of under wraps?
It's, I'm not sure if under wraps is the right word for it, but it's this interesting kind of, this dichotomy of, do you want to be able to move on, which of course we all want to do, or do you want to, it's a question about what is the right way to move on, I think is a better way to put it on my part. But when you talk about trying to move on, it's a question of, do you need to have this permanent remembrance of lives of loss, or is it better to remember what happened to yourself and go and move on? It's tough to know. One of the people I talked to for this story was Erica Doss. She's a professor from the University of Notre Dame. She, by chance, grew up in Wisconsin. And she wrote this really interesting book called Memorial Mania, Public Feeling in America. And it's about kind of a critical look at how Americans tend to remember tragedy. Looking at everything from, you know, a roadside memorial with a cross and flowers and something like that for somebody dying in a car accident or a shooting, for example. Or these really big parks or massive monuments like the ones that you can see at Columbine or at the site of the Oklahoma City bombing. And her argument was that is that these monuments don't necessarily achieve anything. She made a point, it's important to remember these tragedies, whatever they are, but that putting a lot of money and effort and consternation into a building or a park doesn't necessarily bring a public good. She argued that we should be having more policy changes or have memorials actually mean something. One thing that an idea she really was a proponent of was scholarships for affected families, which is something that happened to Molson Coors. And that's kind of what might not be their memorial. They raised, I believe, a couple $1 million for the families of the deceased to basically help them through this pretty horrible time. That's something that she was supportive of, is what you could call an expert in that world.
So has anything changed in the time since these mass shootings? You know, you talked about policy. Has anything changed to make these events less likely to happen in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, to my knowledge, the rules obviously surrounding guns are tough to change, but there are certainly, I think the one thing that, you know, well, I think it's fair to say a very divided political climate. Both sides very much agree that more money is going to mental health, and more money has been going into mental health over the past couple of decades in Wisconsin and nationwide. And mental health has clearly played a role in all four shootings I looked at, one being a hate crime, one being someone with documented mental illness problems, and somebody who's a disgruntled ex who obviously went too far, and these showing signs of very clear mental illness problems. And that's something that a lot of the focus has been on, and there's been more money and more attention put there. When it comes to guns, obviously, I think it's fair to say not a ton has changed. That's something that Erica Doss called for. Of course, plenty of others say that the issue isn't guns. It's people with mental illness problems that lead to these attacks, and that needs more addressed. But really, the literal change that at least Erica Doss, Professor Doss, was looking for hasn't really happened yet.
When you say there's more money going toward mental health? Have we seen more mental health facilities? Have we seen more care in schools? Have we seen more care in the workplace? What has that actually looked like?
From what I've learned and gathered and of course studied as in my work, I found that in the last couple of decades, especially since I was in school, that a lot more schools are putting more money into actually having staff psychologists. Of course, there's massive shortages of that everywhere, especially in Wisconsin. And in Milwaukee, we need more people to be willing to do that and to go into it's a field that needs more professionals. Perhaps because we haven't put the emphasis on it that it maybe needed. In terms of facilities, there hasn't been a lot of growth. I think it's been something that I know that Governor Evers and in Republican leadership actually agree on. But it's something that perhaps I misspoke earlier and that we haven't seen massive change yet, but it's been something that's at least being talked about and something that we could start seeing with more people being willing to open up about mental illness rather than and keeping it down. And that can lead to more people seeking help rather than perhaps going down a dark path that can lead to some pretty bad places.
So it seems like there's been a lot of lip service, at least on the part of politicians, but maybe not a lot of action.
We haven't seen a massive world of change, at least in the past few years. I think that the thing that will start creating that change will be not only pressure by politicians, but also, you know, on a local level in terms of just having more people go into these fields. And I'm not sure how many 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds think about college are thinking, yeah, I want to be a school psychologist. It's not something that's talked about a ton. And perhaps it should be as a really important career field that has benefited a lot of people, and myself included, in that having people who are able to help and willing to help and realizing the importance of professional support systems and how they can really benefit you in your day-to-day life is something that that at least in Wisconsin is not part of our normal day-to-day life, and something that I think could really benefit if we had more help. And I know that's a very broad and vague answer, but more help, especially from people who are trained psychologists and have doctorates in these things that I certainly don't, would be beneficial to all of us, regardless of how extreme our issues might be.
Yeah. All right. Well, Adam Rogan, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
So glad to do it. Thank you so much for having me, Joy.
Adam Rogan is a local journalist whose work was featured in Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers last year. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll learn about Milwaukee's Festival City Symphony and its upcoming season. But first, we talk about four films to see at this year's Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival, which opens today. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Launched by the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition in 2015, the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival shares films from around the world to encourage reflection and meaningful discussion about Muslims and their experiences. The festival kicks off its sixth year of programming today at the Oriental Theater with eight films that transcend countries, languages, and cultures while highlighting the common humanity found in all of us. To share more about this year's lineup, I'm joined by Janan Najib, president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition and founder of the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival. Janan, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the sixth annual Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival starts today with in-person screenings at the Oriental. And, you know, especially after not being able to host this festival as you normally would have in 2020, what are you looking forward to the most with this year's programming?
Well, I'm really excited to be back in person. This is one of the first in-person festivals that is going to take place at the Oriental Theater. And it's a bit of a smaller festival in order to give enough time between each show to be to have the theaters, of course, cleaned, et cetera. But it also gave us an opportunity to really choose 8 phenomenal films. And so I'm really excited about that. And I'm also excited about the fact that we probably have more directors and producers that are showing up in person this year than we have ever had. And I think it's for the same reason, that it's finally an in-person festival and they're excited to be out.
How did the delay of the festival and the pandemic, of course, impact programming in regards to what films maybe you wanted to show last year but then couldn't, and what new films might have been available?
Yes, we were really pretty much set with our festival last year, and we had chosen quite a number of films. And in fact, we had even paid for some of the films. And then, of course, everything got canceled. So by the time this film festival rolled around, you know, a lot of these films are now out. So we could not use any of the films that we had planned to last year. So we have a whole new batch of films, but they're very exciting films.
And, you know, films are one of the best ways to learn about and discuss topics and issues, of course, that are global, right? And when it comes to discussions regarding Muslims in the Muslim world, what do you think is the most important thing for audiences to think about in 2021, whether it's because of the films you're presenting or because these issues are most at top of your mind?
Well, when we started the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival, it was really for the purpose of creating opportunities for discussion using art and film to open the door for discussions on topics that you might not normally discuss with people or have an opportunity to discuss. And so it's definitely important because it draws a crowd that might not come to a lecture or listen to, you know, a particular speaker, for example, but it really opens a window into what's happening globally and also what's happening locally. So we chose films that we felt were important. For example, our opening night film, City of Ali, traces Muhammad Ali, the late great boxer, not so much his life, but really the funeral that took place that brought people in from all around the world, showing the impact, the idea that here was a funeral procession that went on for miles. And he was a Muslim, but he was known, yes, as a boxer, but more importantly, he was known as a humanitarian. He was known as a peace activist. He was known as an individual that stood by his conscience. Most importantly, we wanted to highlight him because in the current state of affairs where many Muslim, you know, children are constantly being told, you are this, you are this, you are this. We want them to really see that, no, look at, here's a Muslim, here's an American Muslim. You can't get more American than Muhammad Ali. And look at who he was and look at the impact he had. And not just for the children, but I think for everyone, you know, at large to see, you know, forget all of these stereotypes that have become rampant. Let's really look at the reality. Who are some of the Muslims that we can identify with?
As you mentioned, City of Ali, that's your opening night film. I want to go through a few other films to highlight for recommendations for our listeners to watch. And next up, we have The Mauritanian. This was released last year during the kind of award season, but as you know, COVID impacted a lot of things, and I'm sure not a lot of people have had the opportunity to see this. So can you give us a preview of what this film is about and what makes it so powerful?
It is definitely a powerful film, and it has some well-known actors, Jodie Foster being one of them. And I think what is impactful about this and why we felt it was important is that we just have, you know, hit the 20-year anniversary of the war on terror and the invasion in Afghanistan. And here is an individual that spent 14 years in Guantanamo Bay. He was tortured. He went through unbelievable difficulties, but he was never charged. He was never charged with a crime, which is the case with the vast majority of individuals that were rounded up and put in Guantanamo. And so it really takes a very serious look at what occurred, you know, our knee-jerk reaction as a country, how we dealt with this incident, how we could have dealt differently, really the mistakes we made, and how it affected the lives of so many people that, you know, I don't want to say we're in the wrong place at the wrong time, because there's no right place where torture and lack of legal representation should be allowed, you know, but it's a very important film, and it's based on the writings of this individual, and it's a true to fact film, and we were trying to bring him over. He's currently in Dubai, but for travel restrictions we could not bring him, but we're going to have a taped interview with him after the film.
Next, we'll head to the West Bank for our next film called The Present.
Yes, and The Present is a short, but it is one of the films that was nominated for an award and an international award. It's won tons of awards, actually, but it's a very powerful film, and it's the day-to-day reality of Palestinians that are under, you know, Israeli rule and have to go through these checkpoints every few yards. And we're going to have a nationally known speaker come and speak afterwards. He's actually a Jewish rabbi who lived in Israel for many years, and he currently lives in Chicago. And he's seen this reality. And so we felt it was important to bring him as a speaker because, you know, people are promoting sometimes a narrative that this is a Muslim-Jewish issue. It is not a Muslim-Jewish issue. It's really those that believe in human rights for all and those that are promoting a kind of a state that only gives rights to a certain part of the population. And so he will be a phenomenal speaker.
One of our last recommendations we'll give to listeners is for a film called The Dissident, and this follows investigating the 2018 murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. I'm sure that must be a kind of a harrowing film to go through.
That's another incredibly powerful film. It keeps you on the edge of your seat throughout the film. There's extensive interviews with Khashoggi's fiance, extensive interviews by individuals that have been monitored by the Saudi government. And in fact, we have heard that a lot of places have refused to show the film because of pressure. And so, you know, our little old festival has decided that no, you know, freedom of speech is very important to us. And we are going to show the film. And we have two, in fact, associate producers coming in from California who are going to discuss the film. They are Turkish themselves. And we're very excited about this.
These are just a few of the selections available for people this weekend for the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival. So, Janann, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today about it more.
Thank you.
Janann Najib is the president of the Milwaukee Muslim Women's Coalition and founder of the Milwaukee Muslim Film Festival. The festival starts today with all in-person screenings at the Oriental Theater. You can find out more information along with the Oriental Theater's COVID policies to attend the event at wuwm.com. Like many arts organizations, Milwaukee's Festival City Symphony has been doing virtual performances since the start of the pandemic. Now, they're returning to the stage with a series of concerts for beginners and experts alike. This weekend, they're kicking off their Saturday Classics series with a concert at the Bradley Symphony Center. Ahead of that, Lake Effect's Joy Powers spoke with Carter Simmons, the music director of the Festival City Symphony and artistic director of the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra.
What is the need that you see this orchestra filling here in Milwaukee?
Well, the Festival City Symphony has had a long tenure here, some say over 100 years, but officially we're 1927. And it started really as the civic orchestra here in the region and in the city. And true to that tradition, the members of the orchestra, as well as the audience of the orchestra, has truly been to enrich Milwaukee and to introduce families and young people to classical music and making it accessible to them, and to be a gateway to other arts. So traditionally, we see a lot of young families, and we bring them in through some of our younger programming. Our Pajama Jamboree concerts are a real tradition of ours, and then we transition them into the concert hall. So our place in Milwaukee is somewhat unique. A lot of the players, they are the players that play in the pit for the ballet, for Broadway musicals. They're in the Skylight. They accompany Bel Canto. There are also lots of the teachers as well. So it's a real community affair when it comes to the Festival City Symphony.
You know, you mentioned how many of the people who engage with Festival City are young people here in Milwaukee. And you, of course, also work with the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra. How do you see your work with that organization complementing what you do with Festival City?
Well, thanks for bringing that up. The Youth Orchestra is the largest in the United States, and really what that organization that I get to be around, we engage students in participating on the instruments. So they're learning how to play the instruments. They're learning how to engage with these master composers and with great teachers, and they're having a community experience as a performer. And then the Festival City Symphony is a way for those families and for other families around the city and the region to engage with composers that they may not have heard before, or maybe really traditional for so many of us, but just these people have never heard these composers before. And so this is a wonderful opportunity, these two organizations, to introduce families and young people to not only playing music, but also appreciating it for their whole lives.
So this season, Festival City is looking forward to having free shows for people. What are some of the other ways that you see Festival City giving back to the city of Milwaukee?
Well, the city has, you know, traditionally been just so welcoming of this orchestra for many years before I was here, during the music director Ed Mumm, and then, of course, Monty Perkins, music director. The city actually helped fund the orchestra for many years, and now we're out on our own, and we're giving back to the community through the generosity of many of our donors, principally the Barbara and Franklin Essenberg Fund, as well as UPAF and many of the other great funders here. And what we want to do is we want to engage these young families and students through free performances, making it just as available as we possibly can to anybody who'd like to see about this and to get started in it and to really enjoy a nice evening out or a nice afternoon out. So there's two principal ways that people can learn about us through our website, festivalcitysymphony.org. One is music for very young audiences. That's our PJ concert. You can come in your PJs, bring your blankies and all that kind of stuff. And that's given at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts in the Bradley Pavilion. And we've got three shows a year that we do that are geared towards introducing instruments and introducing fun pieces and lively pieces with programs that are very engaging. Our next one is December 1st for the holidays. And then those students and those families who'd like to have a little bit more of this, but on a perhaps a little bit more advanced classical stage, we're very delighted to be able to be at the Bradley Symphony Center now. But we're able to offer that experience to everybody complimentary and free. And so that's due to the people that have contributed to the orchestra, and we're very grateful for that.
So looking at this next season, what are you most excited about?
Well, as we all have been through our pandemic here, this orchestra actually never stopped performing. We found a way to continue performing, but you know, with reduced audience and a little different feel. So what I'm really looking forward to is sharing a collective experience with everybody who would like to be with us. This is really a wonderful set of people that perform. They come from all kinds of different professions, but we're all musicians. Some trained at the very best conservatories in the world, And they're all right here to not only perform with each other, but also for those who would love to have a wonderful concert experience. So really what I'm most looking forward to is the energy that we have for performing with each other and then for others. We love to have a wonderful audience, and we always put on a very caring and educational show, something that's engaging for a concert goer that's been going for decades or one who's just brand new to the experience.
All right. Well, Carter, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and good luck on this upcoming season.
Well, thank you so much. We certainly appreciate the attention and highlighting the Festival City Symphony.
Carter Simmons is the music director of Milwaukee's Festival City Symphony and the artistic director of the Milwaukee Youth Symphony Orchestra. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The symphony will be kicking off its Saturday Classics series with a concert this Saturday at the Bradley Symphony Center called Passion, Faith, and Fate. We'll take one last break and then meet the director and producer of the documentary Finding Lauren, who took on the project in honor of her late husband and his father, who was killed in action during World War II. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. First Lieutenant Lorne Hintz of the Army Air Corps was based in Italy near the end of World War II. On April 21, 1945, his P-47 fighter bomber was shot down and he was listed as missing in action until parts of the wreckage were found and he was later declared dead. The late Milwaukee writer Martin Hintz, Lorne's son, was not yet born when his father died. We last spoke with him in 2016 when they had recovered his father's plane 70 years after the crash in an Italian farm field. Martin Hintz passed in 2020, but his wife Pam Percy took it upon herself to produce and direct the documentary Martin was working to make a reality. Finding Lauren details the story of Lauren's life and the effort to find his plane and remains. Percy joined me last month to share more about the documentary.
He hired a cinematographer to go to Italy. There were two trips. One was for the excavation, and the second one was for the big memorial celebration. So when he was in at the excavation and saw the beautiful footage that George Knoll had produced, that's when he decided that this had to be made into a movie. So he got home, he started writing grants, he started getting letters of support, he started the ball rolling, but unfortunately, when he passed away, the film really had not begun. So I was lucky to have all the archival information that his sister had, Gretchen Ronca. She had Lauren's diaries, his autobiography that he wrote when he was 18, and 350 letters that he wrote to Gert throughout the courting period and the war. So this was a huge body of work. And I read all 350 letters and the diary and everything. And then I compiled a timeline and then started using excerpts to create a script. So the first part of the movie is Lauren's life until he passed away or was killed when he was 27 years old. In those 27 years, he accomplished a lot. He was a poet. He was an actor. He wrote. He danced. He did storytelling. He traveled all over the country telling stories.
You mentioned going through all these archives and then trying to lay the foundation for a script of how you'd want to shape this story. What has been your filmmaking or documentary making experience before this? Or was it something that you just dove into?
I just dove into it. I have done other projects. I produced a radio show called Hotel Milwaukee, and I organized festivals and I've written a lot. Marty and I wrote a couple books together. So I had sort of the foundation, but I certainly have never made a film before. So I luckily was talking to a friend and said I was looking for an editor. And she suggested that I contact Bill Warner, who was a producer at Wisconsin Public Television. And he suggested Claudia Luz. So Claudia and I have been working on this film now for 9 months. And it was day in and day out, back and forth, emails, Zooms. I'd send her a script. She'd send me some footage. We'd discuss it. And it evolved. It was an exciting project to see this film come to being.
Well, and what's so great about the first part of the film is that most of it is in Lauren's own words, because you have all of these letters. Unfortunately, the letters he and his wife sent to each other during his basic training, Gertie's letters, weren't found. But there's such a plethora of things that gives you insight into this man. So what was it like for you to get a glimpse into to who Lauren was through these documents?
I was just constantly amazed what a kind person he was. He reminded me so much of Marty. He even used some of the same expressions that Marty used, like the word kiddo. And Marty used the word kiddo a lot. And I know that Marty had not read his diaries, you know, for a very long time. So that DNA was pretty strong. You know, he loved life. He was enthusiastic. He was positive. He wanted to go serve his country. And he just kept plugging away and became a P-47 fighter pilot, which is quite a daunting task.
Your late husband, Marty, he never met his father. We should note to the audience that Lauren died in the plane crash before Marty was born. And one of Gertie's letters, Lauren's wife, to Lauren's parents says that, you know, he will be, quote, a good model to follow for the kids, even in death. So what do you believe the main characteristics were of Lauren that was passed down to his family?
Well, I think he was honorable. I didn't see a mean bone in his body. He was optimistic. He was artistic and just a kind and generous person, I felt. And that certainly was passed along to Marty. All of the attributes of Lauren, Marty inherited. That DNA, as I said, is very strong.
You mentioned in 9 months you were able to get this documentary together, which was very impressive. I feel like documentaries most of the time are years long projects.
I know. Everyone is very surprised. We really pushed. Yeah, I was hoping to get it done by the year anniversary of Marty's death. And we made that goal. It was just completely finished just maybe a week ago. And it's beautiful. The music of John Seeger is fabulous. He's created amazing original music to go with the story.
This whole film and the many people that put this together, it's such a massive effort between your family. There's organizations, people in Italy that also contributed. And it's such a long effort, but well worth it. So Lauren's grandson, Hans Ronka, he led the effort to recover this plane. And that was more than 70 years since the crash. And in 2019, Lauren's remains were properly laid to rest in Italy. And now in 2021, this documentary is complete. So how does this experience of making this film feel for you and the rest of the family to have this next chapter of Lauren's life completed in a way?
I think they're all thrilled. I think they are pleased with the outcome of the film. It stays true to all the facts of the experience in Lauren's life.
This film, and it's both parts of its life, one in highlighting Lauren the man and then the effort to find his plane crash site, you know, it shows both the strength that he had and the courage and what he went through in life, but also shows how, you know, it's not always great to over-romanticize war and the many ways it impacts a lot of people. So what do you hope people take away from learning about your family and the story of Lauren Hintz?
The Hintz and the Ronca families became very close to the Italians that worked on this project. Their friendships were formed that will last forever. And the Italians are so grateful to the Americans for they saving them. They look at Lauren Hintz as a hero. There are special occasions in Italy, Lauren Hintz Day, and he's a very well-known figure in Italy. So I think the two worlds have come together and it's very moving.
So before we wrap this up, I was hoping you could read your husband's poem called Bones of My Father that's featured at the end of the documentary.
I'd love to. And in the documentary, it's read by Daniel Hintz, Marty's son. I touch the bones of my father, hard, unbreakable, and fearless. They still talk to me in long phrases, but not long enough because he is gone.
Well, and he's not totally gone. He lives through in this documentary.
He will live on in this film. And so will Marty. Marty is featured in this film. It's a story of Marty finding his father as well. There are a lot of stories that are going on in this. So very, it's very touching, very moving.
It is a moving documentary. I can attest to that. And Pam, I want to thank you so much for sharing your insights with me and for the work you've done on this.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pam Percy is the director and producer of the documentary Finding Lauren. We spoke last month. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mallory Chang and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Bex Salgado, Chase Browning, and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Bentz and Emily Files from the WUWM News team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager, and Valeria Navarro-Villegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to hear our favorite interviews from the week, just look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.